Hello, my name is Debbie Boone, and I want to welcome you to my podcast, The Bend, where we explore how successful people navigated the path and emerged in a better place when life threw them an unexpected twist. It's inspired by one of my favorite sayings, "The bend in the road is not the end of the road unless you fail to make the curve." These conversations will hopefully help you and inspire you to embrace your personal bend and to flourish. I hope you enjoy it, and if you need help with your own personal navigation and you're in veterinary medicine, please feel free to reach out to me at Debbie Boone, Two Managed Vets Consulting. Enjoy the bend and be inspired by our wonderful guest. Welcome. Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's episode of The Bend. Now, today I have a guest, and this is the first time we have ever met, even virtually, but we've been having conversations on LinkedIn, and I was so interested in what he had to say that I invited him to be a guest on the show. So today I have Dr. Tim Ireland, and he is a VMD, so that means he's a Penn grad. All those VMDs always are the Penn's grads. He was born and raised in Philadelphia. He graduated from the Pennsylvania School of Vet Medicine in 1990. He found a job at Newtown Veterinary Hospital after he graduated, and then he turned around and bought the practice in 1992. He is passionate about all aspects of veterinary care, but like soft tissue orthopedic surgery and dentistry. And he has also served on the board of the Pennsylvania Veterinary Medical Association as the vice president, president-elect, and president in 2005. As the former president of an association, I know exactly how that goes, Doc. And sometimes that volunteer duty you get into, you go, what was I thinking to do that? But he spends time outside of his office with his wife, Linda, his son, Tim II, two daughters, Abby and Angelina. And of course, there's a variety of critters that live with the group, the Great Pyrenees, Annie, Maverick and MacGyver, who are golden retrievers, service dogs in training, which is wonderful, Einstein the Maltese, what a great name, Phoebe the parrot, three bearded dragons, a flock of chickens, and two cows named Milkshake and Buttercup. Those are perfect names for cows. I love that. His practice is also accredited, fear-free. He is fear-free certified and cat-friendly gold. So he's just doing all the right things, I think, to be a great practice owner. So Tim, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I always like to ask the origin story of my guest. What possessed you to decide to be a veterinarian?
Right. I was actually asked that question at my vet school interview, and my answer was I never decided that it's really the only thing I ever wanted to do, that more of a vocation than a job. And so I don't remember ever really deciding. I feel like it was just what I was born to do.
I understand that completely. I was one of those kids at the age of five. I was determined I was going to be a veterinarian. And not only that, I was going to be an equine veterinarian because I was a horse girl. And after 4 years of undergraduate at NC State, I went, you know, I think I'm done with that. I'd rather ride horses than work on them. And so I decided to manage doctors instead, which was for me the perfect job. I got to be in the periphery of everything. I got the science of it, which I loved, and I never had to do anything to an animal that they wouldn't like. So there you go. But
except that we're not very manageable usually.
No, that's true. That's true. It's herding cats, literally and figuratively herding cats to keep doctors pointed in the right direction. But tell me, I mean, you were a fairly new doctor and you bought a practice kind of right off the gate. How did that work out for you?
It really worked out great. I mean, the practice was basically a 1.5 doctor practice, when I started, and I had my goal set on growth and had a lot of ideas about how we might grow. Made a lot of mistakes along the way, but, plugged through and I guess had the misguided thoughts that I could learn as I go. And I did to some extent, but now I've always been a fan of bringing in an outside voice to assess how we're going and give me guidance. I'm not a veterinarian or owner that ever thought that I can do everything. That when I bought my practice at, I was only 2.5 years out of school. I had 6 employees, 4 were full-time and 2 were part-time. And one of the full-time employees was appointed office manager, slash practice manager, because I knew that I was still learning how to be a vet, that I couldn't keep up with the human resource side and all that goes along with that.
So now I'm curious, because I see this as a consultant and just as somebody who's been in the profession 38 years, there's a lot of times that we promote somebody who's really good at being a CVT or a CSR in our practice, and we promote them to practice manager, but then we leave them hanging out to dry. We don't give them any education on how to be a good leader or how to be a good manager. How did you raise that manager up so that she actually knew how to manage a hospital?
Right. And early on, I would say I did not very well do that. That she was an accountant by trade. And so she was, the books side of it was easy for her. I had hoped that we could figure out the leadership side of that together. That she was probably with me 2.5 years, which would have been before I hired another full-time vet. So I had a couple of, the previous owner was working part-time. I had another doctor working part-time. And she received a really nasty letter in the mail that clearly came from somebody that had inside information about the practice. At that time, we were still closed at lunchtime. We finished up our morning appointments and I called everybody into the treatment room and shared the letter with them and asked who wrote it, and nobody stepped up. And I said, well, you have 2 hours to either figure out who did this or to clear my schedule the rest of the day, because I can't work with somebody that would write something so mean. And I went to my apartment that was upstairs, and about an hour later, 2 of my employees came up and they thought they had figured out a recently departed employee that might have done that. And so I had to do my appointments that afternoon, but I did lose my manager over it. That she was, it was nasty.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. And so my next one I actually got from human resource, that she had worked in Harrisburg, and had that side of it. And she was with me when we brought Mark Opperman in the first time. I tried to get her involved with, local practice managers and manager groups as support. And Linda was probably with me 10 years. I have number 4 now. Number 3 was actually an internal promotion, was a CVT, and who I knew, would be a great manager, but had concerns about her. And I had known her from when she worked in the kennel. It was now almost 20 years later. And had concerns about her financial irresponsibility as a young person, but didn't want to hold that against her, and had an outside consultant come in and interview the people that were interested, which was an accounting firm, so then we shipped her out there to learn the financial aspects of it. In 2007, we had Sean McVeigh in and did like a practice retreat and vision statement, core values, and CE for everybody, big fan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I love the fact that you talked about the core values work, because you just kind of decided to do that again, right? Or you're new, you kind of brushed up the cobwebs of what you had and decided to revamp your vision and mission statement?
I did. I rewrote my vision statement, and that is the first step. The core values we'll probably revisit. Right now, I'm in the process of kind of recreating my practice and rebuilding my leadership team after a pretty traumatic year last year.
Well, I think COVID threw us all a curveball, and the strong survived, quite honestly, because I felt personally like I was drinking out of a fire hose for almost a year and a half there trying to figure out how to help more than anything else. There were so many questions that were unknown, and we didn't know, you know, what was going to happen. I said the thing that I really found brought me a lot of joy during that time was to look at the collaboration of complete strangers, managers particularly, who just got together and offered solutions that they had found of how to manage remote consultations and how to manage the parking lot and how to split teams and what happened with, you know, sanitation protocols. Because honestly, if we hadn't worked together, we would have just, I think as a profession, would have sunk completely. Mm-hmm. We floundered around a little bit, but we didn't sink completely. And we struggled a lot during that period of time. I feel like much of the pressure has been relieved. Of course, I don't work in practice, but I talk to people all the time who are in practice. I feel like the hiring is getting a little bit, is easing up a little bit. I feel like people are managing the workflows a little bit better, that it's not just this craziness that was happening during 21 and 22. Going a little bit back to normal. Is that kind of what you're seeing in your practice?
Definitely. And I think, you know, we're going to start to see the pendulum swinging back, that, you know, the retention bonuses that they call signing bonuses, I think is not sustainable. And so it's not a question of if they'll go away, but when. And I think, in my opinion, a lot of the corporate practices are messing up enough that people are learning very quickly that there's more to the job than what you're getting paid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was hiring for a veterinarian for one of my clients, and the header of the ad was corporate refugees welcome.
Yeah, that's good.
So I think I do think you're right. I think somebody made a comment to me one day that corporate buyers thought they were buying self-cleaning ovens and were stunned to find out how much work there was on the operations side when they all of a sudden owned 50 hospitals, and that there was a lot of work to be done there. And especially when they were transitioning into a different leadership model, a different practice model, and people were not being coached on change very well. And there was a lot of attrition during that period of time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that there was some positives to corporate, and I'm personally a huge advocate for independent practice owners. I think it's a bad idea for bankers to manage medicine. And I think that the good things that did happen were benefits improved generally across the population. I feel like wages went up. I feel like the value of licensed and credentialed technicians were brought to the forefront more so than ever. And I also feel like that we found out it doesn't matter how much money people pay you if you're miserable every day at work and you're handcuffed, which is what those retention bonuses really ended up being in a lot of situations. Were, well, I called them golden handcuffs, because they were not bonuses. They were loans. And if you did not honor your contract, then guess what? You were responsible for paying those back. But you've been through a lot of life here in VetMed. So what do you think was your toughest challenge as practice owner?
Bless you. Without a doubt, it was, I had had 17 years of solid growth, from the day that I took the wheel, and most years double-digit growth. When I went from one full-time associate to two, so three veterinarians, we grew 28% that year. I never had 2 months in the same calendar year that were behind the same month the year before. And October of 2008 was behind 07. And I had October, November, December, January, February 19th, we moved into a new hospital. And my expenses went up 40%. And growth was flat. I avoided having a down year by, I think, 3 cents. but yeah, I had 3 years in a row that I didn't draw a salary. That I think is probably harder in the middle of your career than it is if you're, you know, just opening a startup. Emptied all of my savings and investment accounts to keep the doors open and keep my people paid. And, you know, really sacrificed a lot for my staff. And so finding out, well, it was in the, not even at the tail end of that, but, you know, to have an accounting firm that I hired to watch my money, because I was entrusting it to someone that I didn't fully trust. And my wife was disabled, and in 2009 spent 27 weeks in the hospital. And
oh my gosh.
When my kids were 8, 12, and 13, 8, 11, and 12. So I was pretty busy and occupied. In 2011, my accountant informed me that my business was officially a hobby in the eyes of the IRS because I had 3 consecutive years without taxable income. And then I learned that my manager had been stealing from me and had hoodwinkled the people that were watching her so well that they had done things that actually helped her hide it. That about broke me.
Oh my gosh. That is a hard lesson to learn. And back in 2008, I was managing an 11-doctor practice, and I started getting conversations coming at me from all my sales rep friends that I had known for 20 years. And they were telling me all these stories about embezzlement. And there was pilfering, and then there was flat out hundreds of thousands of dollars stolen from some of these practices. And so I actually was one of the first talks I ever gave for a conference was about embezzlement and watching all the different buckets that you could possibly find that people were pilfering from. And, you know, most of the money that gets stolen from a hospital is small amounts of money that's stolen from the register. And usually it's by the CSRs. But when your managers get involved, that's when it gets up into the thousands and tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I actually had a friend owned a practice in my town, Greensboro, North Carolina, who, like you, had a manager that he raised from a kennel person and had known her since she was 16 years old, gave her complete autonomy. And she had stolen over $350,000 from them. And they found out when the IRS came to lock their practice because she had paid none of the payroll taxes. And that's how he found out that she had stolen all that money. And so fortunately, he was able to, you know, do a quick help, plea for help and pay it back. But still, I mean, it's just heartbreaking. And so when I was giving this talk, I asked a couple of friends who were police officers, why do people steal? Because it was a concept that was beyond me. I mean, I had complete autonomy as a practice manager, and I could have robbed my boss blind and he would have never known. But I would have known, you know, so I was meticulous about everything. But he said, usually these guys said, it's a crime of opportunity where people will start with a small amount. Nobody pays attention to it. And then it gets a little bit bigger. And then they justify it to themselves that they are doing all the work and the owner's not doing anything. And they, you know, are self-justifying that they deserve this money. And then they get buried into so much that they can't get themselves out of it. And so it just snowballs into vast amounts of money. So I'm curious, is when you found this out, did you prosecute this person?
I did. Well, I attempted to. And that was as traumatic as the whole thing. because in the end, you know, the DA, the ADA and the detective on the case had said, you know, that usually if somebody's stealing, they find one way to steal and, you know, continue to use that, whether it's forging checks or stealing from the register, or, and they had never seen somebody that found so many different ways to steal. And she was, her parents were connected enough that nothing happened the way that the detective or the ADA thought it should happen or told me it was going to happen. And in the end, the DA told me he was pleading it out because it was too complicated of a case, and that he wasn't going to use taxpayer money to get me my money back. And I said, when did I ever ask for my money back? You know, the sign outside your door says, you know, to serve and protect. And who are you serving other than her? And you're certainly not protecting her next employer.
Right.
Because they pled, and I think it was closer to $500,000. We charged her with 3.25. They pled it down to misdemeanor theft of like less than $2,000 or something. She had 7 years probation.
Oh, my word. Now, did you have insurance that covered the employee theft?
I did, a whole $10,000 worth.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. I'm telling you, it's you know, and the struggle is just exactly what you said, tend not to prosecute because a lot of times you catch them before it's gone to this extreme, and it's not enough to warrant the labor that it takes to find the paper trail. And then they go out and they do it again. And they do it again and they do it again because there is no track record of embezzlement that follows behind them. It's white collar crime. And that is really tough. I imagine it was hard to hire another practice manager and trust them after that.
Well, actually, my sister-in-law comes from finance and was in between jobs at the time. She came down from Connecticut, which is 3-hour commute, fell in love with what we do. And, you know, left a world where her annual bonuses were more than I could afford to pay her for the whole year. But she's been commuting from Connecticut for 13 years.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow.
Comes down on Monday and stays at my house and goes home Thursday, works from home on Friday.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
Well, works from home on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Wow. Now, you know, that is really a challenge. How did you overcome that and move forward? Because now you're an 8-doctor practice. You've just kind of, you know, revitalized your mission and getting ready to, I think you're trying to hire another veterinarian. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. And so I just hired a medical director, which I had hired one that was going to partner into the practice. 13 or 14 years ago, and 4 years in, when we were getting closer, you know, to writing things up, her first child was old enough for preschool, and she had been commuting from an hour away, and so she knew she had to either convince her husband to move closer to here, or she needed to work closer to home, and her husband had a 5-minute commute at the time that he was not willing to give up on. And so I lost her and really have been looking since then, but you know, found a great medical director that I almost hired 2 years ago and corporate won out. Took her 18 months to realize that corporate really doesn't want managers with an opinion, veterinary managers with an opinion. It's really like I thought I had recovered, you know, with a lot of counseling and a number of years, you know, to move beyond, you know, a true dread of coming to work every day, until I hired this manager. She brought her practice manager with her, who's going to, I'm reconfiguring my leadership team, and I'm hiring managers rather than supervisors. And read The E-Myth Veterinarian, which I very strongly recommend. And I just have an energy for practice and a joy that I haven't had in a long time. I've always treated my staff like family, but always, had the drama and issues that so many vets complain about. This past Christmas was the first in 34 years that I had lower level staff that brought a gift for every single employee to the holiday celebration. I really feel like we had a traumatic year in that we lost a 24-year office manager to cancer. I lost a 20-year head tech to just an opportunity she couldn't say no to, that her family needed her to say yes to. So tested my, I've always said family first, and that was probably the hardest one that I had to smile and congratulate her as she left. And that was a painful one, but stayed true to my mantra, and then lost our receptionist since then. Was part-time mostly, but had been here 18 years. And I realized that every employee that was here at the time of the embezzlement were gone. And so it truly is, a rebirth of the practice. And that was when I decided I need everybody to know what my new vision is. I think veterinary medicine is in crisis, from a mental health perspective, but also from, a staffing perspective, and that the only thing we know for sure is, I like your guest, the only thing that we know for sure is that we can't keep doing what we're doing. Yeah. And so I need really smart people that can think outside the box. And my hiring strategy was, to target personality and aptitude, varied experience. My whole veterinary life has been in the same hospital. And mm-hmm. so, I needed people with varied backgrounds. I have had people that knew me for a long time that came back, wanting to join me, a past employee that left and got a whole slew of varied experiences, and he came back, people that are interested in getting credentialed. I have as motivated a crew as I've ever had, with the emphasis that I've made on CBTs and requiring it for anesthesia in a state that doesn't support that. I have 9 assistants enrolled in online school to get their CBT.
That's fantastic.
And yeah. So it's just has really, they have pulled me out of the fire, more or less. And the fire went out a long time ago, but I think I was still carrying more of that than I thought.
Right. Yeah. So they rekindled the flame. They blew a little fresh flame rekindled it. Well, I'm like you. I've been doing this for a long time, and I've lived through the recession. And one of the things I remember right when COVID hit was doing a little video, and I don't know what inspired me to do it, but I just felt like for people who've been doing things a long time, adversity is going to happen to you in life. And obviously you've been through the fire, and I mean, I've had cancer. I lost my job in 2009 in the middle of a recession. It's when I started my consulting business, and it flourished because that's when people needed a lot of help. And so it was kind of, the timing was kind of weird, but it was good. And there's been a lot of things that, that have happened in my life that I look back on now, and they gave me an experience that I could use to help other people during this really, this time of crisis, which is one of the reasons that I started this podcast and vodcast, because I felt like particularly young people who had never been through anything this hard needed to know that it would be okay, that we would come out on the other side, that Yeah, things do get hard, but we learn best by failure. And we learn some very hard lessons, but we learn some lessons that make us much better at what we're doing as we move through life and as we get a little bit more experience under our belt. And some of those things we're like, oh gosh, you know, I could have done without it, right? I definitely could have done without having cancer. I could have done without losing my job in a recession. But then you look back and go, these are things that really taught me very, very valuable things about what I do now and how I'm able to help now. And, you know, I just wrote this book called Hospitality and Healthcare. And looking back on it, if I had not had the experience of being treated in human health and having really good experiences at Duke Medical Center and really horrible experiences at other places, I would not have been able to tell the stories that I told in the book and be able to illuminate how to do it right and how to not do it and bring that into veterinary medicine. So everything works for the good if you look at it that way and you look at it as an experience. And I'm quite sure that you have enough systems in place that nobody will ever steal from you again after looking back at what happened here in the past. Your focus is strong on who's doing what there in your practice. So I do want to talk a little bit about your goal going forward, because you have a practice that people want to buy. And I'm quite sure that you get those solicitations probably every single day from some consolidator group somewhere out there that says, hey, doc, you know, we'll come and give you vast amounts of money for your 8-doctor practice that's AHA accredited and has 31 years in of great client experiences. But you have made a concerted choice that you will not do that. So I'm curious as to what your strategy is long term, and how important you feel that is for you personally going forward, but for the profession in general, is to set that model.
Yeah, that's where I've always had kind of a broader view of the profession than most, and why I ended up pretty early in my career serving on, with the state board, because I had a situation where, I felt like I needed their support, and they basically just said, yes, that's really important. Good luck with that. I hope you figure it out. And I didn't think that was what a state organization should be. Have never been one to complain about something and not raise my hand to try to make it better. And, I just hate what I see happening in veterinary medicine, that there was a time that I thought corporate vet med would be a good thing, because I just was naive enough to think, if you consolidate all these things that we don't need in every practice, that we can farm that stuff out and focus on the patient, and we could deliver even better care, raise everybody's standard of care, and do it for less. clearly that's not their goal. I'm worried about the profession, and I just turned 60 a couple months ago, and was at a point in my career that admittedly I was coasting. I thought that I could kind of coast to retirement. Still didn't have a solid exit strategy, because I really didn't want to sell to corporate. I just, all the things that I didn't like about corporate and all the damage I felt that they were doing, I really didn't think that a family-owned entity that was the top of the pyramid, that wasn't going to try to roll it up to the next consolidator, I never dreamed that they could make it so much worse. But they clearly have in my market. So I just, with an opportunity to kind of reinvent and rebuild my practice, at the end of a calendar year, January is a time of rebirth. I started getting excited about the idea of, really making my practice what I've always wanted it to be. It helped me get the people that I wanted on board. I'm still looking for a nurse manager, but that'll complete the leadership team. I have engaged Alyssa Mages with elevating vet teams so that we can ensure that we have a pathway for growth for every position in the hospital, and make sure that we're communicating with each other on an appropriate level. And I'm excited. I think I'm more excited than I was when I first started. Because when I first started, I was almost as scared as I was excited. I knew that I needed to be owner, and I graduated with the highest debt in my class. And I knew I couldn't pay my loans if I didn't own a practice. It was scary. It was probably not as scary as it would have been if I had a wife and kids at the time. But like you said, everything happens for a reason. I was somewhat depressed that I was still single. The only thing I ever wanted more than being a vet was to be a dad. But I couldn't have put the hours that I put in to get things off the ground if I had a family waiting for me. So now, I have a very clear vision. I know it's important to put your vision in writing. I've done that. I need the core values that I've published were written with my team in 2007. And so I no longer have anybody in the building other than myself that was here in 2007. And so I think that whether we stay with the core values or the same values or not, I think they deserve an opportunity to weigh in on those.
I think you're doing something really valuable, and I don't see a lot of practices doing this, or I wrote an article once on mission statements, and basically they're a waste of time if you don't put them into play, because we write these mission statements, and then I've read hundreds of them, and they all sound exactly the same. They're like, we're doing good medicine, we're going to give great service, and we love animals, blah, blah, blah. And we don't put any passion in it. We don't put any heart in it. And we don't put what really moves us to do the work that we do in those missions. And it won't move our team either. So we have to figure that this is the North Star of our business. And every decision that we make, every piece of equipment we buy, every person that we hire has got to match that vision for where we are going. And they've got to believe what we believe. And if they don't, then they will never be a good fit in our team. And that's where, the interviewing part of it, two core values, matters. And I see a lot of practices who don't lay that foundation. And that is truly the pillars of your practice have to do with what you believe and why you do your work and what you value and how you will live those values every day. I was recently doing a VMG workshop on leadership, and I asked them to work on their core values, and many of them, their primary core value was compassion. And I went, okay, compassion is good, but if you give compassion as a core value, is it compassion to the point where your team feels like they can give services away because they're being compassionate, but now you can't pay a living wage because your team is giving things away? So you have to really think about those core values and dig deep into the actions behind them, more so than these are just words and this is what we believe. Okay, let's really dig into them. And getting your team to do that, I think, is extremely valuable. And it's something I've done several times. And it's just amazing how exciting it is to people who are working in a practice to be asked those things. And to say, this is how we would live that. This is how we would manifest it every day. This is not some hypothetical. This is how we will do it here in our community, here in our business, here to each other. And I know I'm preaching to the choir, but I'm very excited about this stuff. So I think this is one of the cores of what is wrong with our profession, is that we've lost the vision. We've lost the purpose. We've lost the passion for what we do. And it's it's being buried in production numbers and, you know, revenue streams and time and motion studies. And not that those aren't important. I'm a management consultant, I'm an operations consultant. I believe in those things, but it cannot be the focus. It cannot be the focus of what we do.
And that's really, you know, I think to go back to what you said about mission, I think it's the difference between a mission statement and a vision statement. Because we actually have both. Like in veterinary medicine, your mission is going to have something to do with the animals. The vision statement, like you said, that's your North Star, that's your compass. And my mission now is to show the world that veterinary medicine can be successful and profitable while putting your people and your patients first. Mm-hmm. And I know I can do that, that I've been doing that sometimes successfully, sometimes a little less for those 3 years that I had no income. But I've never lost sight of that being more important than the profit. And so I know that it can be done. I can do it better than I'm doing it now. And I'm surrounding myself with people that can help me get that done. That I think, you know, my approach to veterinary medicine has always, you know, to become a veterinarian, you've got to have, a little more than average ego and self-confidence. But I think to be a leader that says the patient always comes first, you got to check your ego at the door. And I think, you know, that I've been successful in doing that and staying true to my word. When I say something, I mean it and I'll follow through on it. And I like to meet with every new hire if they've made it through the people that they need to. And I'm never going to tell my team, you know, you can't hire that person because of the time that I spent with them, but I want to be part of the process because I share those core values and my vision with them. And I tell them that not only am I sharing this because if you agree to come work for us, you agree to support these values and my vision, but I'm sharing it with you because I'm empowering you to hold me accountable if I'm not living these values and if I'm not heading in the right direction. And so I think there's two sides of that, I don't just want them, you know, rowing in the same direction, but if management, is rocking the boat, then they all have, a kind of a duty to speak up about that.
Mm-hmm. I think that is always a challenge. Is for people to give feedback to people who are supervising them, and particularly to a practice owner. I know I managed the practice for 19 years and I shared an office with my practice owner. So it was very easy for us to, you know, share ideas back and forth. And I had worked for him so long that I really felt like I could say things to him that maybe nobody else was afraid to say. And the manager is a good buffer between practice owner and the team when they do play that role as the go-between a lot of times. And, you know, I think that sometimes business decisions have to be made. And unless we have somebody who is explaining what's going on to the team, they don't really understand, you know, why we're buying this new piece of equipment and I haven't had a raise. Well, you know, because we've done some work and we know that this is a service that we can offer and it's a good revenue stream, and then we will be able to give some raises because of this revenue stream. But I feel like a lot of times people in leadership don't think they answer to the people who work for them. And I've always felt like we should talk to people. Everybody should know what's going on in your practice. That doesn't say that everybody should know what everybody is making, although they probably do anyway, because they all talk to each other. And that is the greatest fallacy in vet med, is that people don't talk about how much they make. It's ridiculous. Of course they do. And then we could get them on board to help us be creative, because you've said several times, we need to think outside the box. We can't keep doing it the way we've always done it, because it doesn't work that well anymore. It might work in some places, but it's not going to be satisfactory for us anymore. We're not going to love it and enjoy it the way it should be enjoyed. And yeah, it's work. You know, it is always going to be a job and work. So I think we have to be realistic, is there's going to be days that it just sucks because, you know, it's going to have a hard day. We're going to have a hard day where people are difficult and or cases are tough or something tries to eat us for lunch. And those are just the days that are in vet med, but they don't happen every day. And we also need to remember to train our brain to look at all the good things that happen and the appreciation that our clients have for us and the appreciation for the successes that we have. So to me, I'm not a technician. I have a degree in animal science. I was always a manager, but there was nothing more gratifying than seeing some animal come in and you knew it was going to die with its next breath. And 3 days later, have it walk out the door wagging its tail. It's like a miracle. And we need to appreciate the miracles that our doctors pull off every single day and understand that that is a gift. You know, that is a gift to appreciate.
No, I've always seen the potential in everything. And so it is work for me to remind myself periodically to step back and look how far we've come, because I always see more that we could be doing and more that we could accomplish. And I wouldn't be where I am today without my people. And so, you know, the veterinary medicine, you know, across the board has to make that a priority. And the sooner that corporate figures that out, the better, because they're not going away.
No, they're not. They're not. I think they're figuring out that they really need to spend more time in operations. And I do appreciate some of the posts that you make, and it's kind of the DEI stuff and the well-being stuff. It's a little bit of whitewash, but there's at least there are options for people out there in the world. We are having a conversation about things that we can do to improve the mental health of our teams. And I think sometimes we have to realize too, that we are not the cause of a lot of our team's stress. Some of the stress is happening at home, and we often can be the safe haven for those people if we build a culture that is safe for them to come into and that they do have somebody they can talk to. We tend to make ourselves the bad guy all the time, but sometimes we are really the good guy, and we are the ones that are the harbor in the storm. And, you know, going home is where the storm lies.
Yeah. Now, and how many times have you heard as a consultant, you know, to my employees, it's just a job. That, you know, I think as leaders, that's our fault.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
To some degree. And so, you know, that when Mark Opperman was out the first time, you know, we had, you know, as part of our vision, that I think his quote was, you know, you want to create an environment where clients are afraid to leave for fear of a harsher world outside. And I've kind of twisted that to, you know, most of us spend more time at work than we do inside our homes other than sleeping. Yeah. Like that work should be the place that you're afraid to leave because of the harsher world outside.
Yeah. In my practice, I actually had to make a rule in the employee manual that you could leave once and you could come back, but you could leave again and be rehired because it was not fair. Because people would, you know, there was all the grass is greener down the road for like 50 cents more. And they would come back and go, these people are mean and I don't want to work there. Can I come back? I'm like, sure, you can come back. But, you know, you can't be a revolving door just because you go out and test the water somewhere. They're not nice. But I had, like you, I had people who stayed for years and you, I mean, like 15 years, 20 years, 30 years. And because of that, the clients were so comfortable with those people that there was a great deal of safety, not only for the client, but for, you know, they just felt like we always had their back. And when your clients are getting a divorce and they come in to tell your CSRs about it and to cry on their shoulder, you know, you've made the connection, you know, that that's where you need to be. And that's, really the whole premise of me writing a book about hospitality, because that's how I grew up in the restaurant business, is with these regular customers who we knew so well that we almost read their minds about what they wanted to have for lunch. And I just brought that into veterinary medicine, because we can do that. We can know our clients so well that we are, you know, we're there for them in times of struggle and strife, and they feel like we have their back. And that's, it should never be transactional. In my mind, it should always be relational. And when we have that and we build that, we build a practice that's just a lot of fun to work in, because we don't have people who are constantly fussing at us about things, because there's trust that's built. And you can have a conversation with people about difficult topics, about money and about, you know, food. God help us that we talk about food. And that's always a challenging discussion. But we can, because people don't feel like we are looking down on them. I feel like a lot of times we come at people as an authority rather than a collaborator. And that's a mistake. The knowledge lies within the walls, but that doesn't mean that you have to come at it from that way, that you are more, I do the same thing with consulting. I'm a coach. I just try to help you get where you want to go. And our clients, we can do the same thing. Our clients are the heroes of the story. It's not us. We are the Obi-Wan Kenobi to our clients. We are the wise counselor that guides them there to get them where they want to go. Well, Tim, I know, you know, our time is almost up, and I know your time is valuable, and I really appreciate this, but I'm just curious, any final words of wisdom that you would like to give to practice owners or aspiring practice owners out there in the world, looking at the things that you've learned over 31 years as a practice owner, and kind of where you see the light at the end of the tunnel in vet bed going forward in the future?
Right. I guess I'm to students and young veterinarians. Like when I got out of school, as I mentioned, with the highest debt in my class, my thought process was, I need to be an owner to get rid of my debt as quickly as possible. And it seems like now that somehow is flipped over. I can't afford to be a practice owner because I have too much debt. And it really is the fastest road to financial independence. And to the owners that, you know, are at a point in their career, like I might be if I wasn't rebirthing my practice. I think that as owners, we can give our associates a better insight into what it means to be an owner. And the not just the financial aspects of it, but, you know, having some say. And I've always been a very democratic leader, and so I try to give everybody a voice. But, you know, the control that you have over the vision and the direction the practice takes, I think because we don't mentor as well as maybe we could, the future owners, they only see the bad part.
Right. Yes.
We don't give them enough insight into the upside. And I just wouldn't have accomplished all I have accomplished as an associate when my wife was disabled. You know, was able, and I had built the practice up enough that I was able to stop working nights and weekends, you know, to get home and get my kids off the bus. And you know, I have probably more of a relationship with my kids than I might have if my wife hadn't gotten sick. And so I think, you know, we talk about work-life balance and all of the mental health issues. I think being an owner gives you a little bit more control control in your own life and your own schedule. And, you know, from a financial standpoint, it's, and I put all of my profit back into the practice. And so I don't have a huge nest egg out there. And I think a lot of veterinarians don't find the balance, and that I've probably put too much of my profit back in. But there's some that take all the profit out and then don't understand why nobody wants to buy this business that has allowed them to accumulate so much wealth. And it's probably because, you know, your x-ray machine's 30 years old and you know, that your facility still has that pale green Formica countertops and
yellow from the 70s.
And so, you know, I think that there's a balance, you know, that we need to be willing to put enough of the profit back into the business. I've never achieved 20% net profit. I know it's possible, but I'm thrilled with 10%, and, you know, put the other 10% that some owners are taking out back into my people and back into my practice.
I think that is the most valid point that you have made, that we do not share the positives of practice ownership and the associates only see the negatives. And you're exactly right about that, because they only see the hours you put in or the business management stuff that's kind of done behind closed doors. And so when it is done behind closed doors, it becomes this big secret. And I was just recently training a manager when the bookkeeper quit. I went, you can do this. Keeping QuickBooks is like keeping your personal checkbook. It is no more complicated than that. And you can do this. And she's like, oh, it's so overwhelming. I went, it's not really. I said, it just appears to be that way. But it's something that is not that. If you got through vet school, you can do basic math that is required to manage your money and watch that come in and out and know what you've spent and know that you can't spend more than you've got. And so, yeah, that point that you you do have control, you can build the culture that you want. It is entirely up to you to do that. And so, yeah, is it a little intimidating to go into it? But I'm working with a brand new practice owner now, and she's been open 1 year. And she's like, I learned in the VBMA what all these numbers were, but now I don't know what to do with them. So I have these numbers, and now what? We can talk about the now what. But that's that. She said, I always wanted to be a practice owner. It was always on my radar. And I feel like there, like you said, a lot of young veterinarians out there now who are really intimidated, and their confidence level is diminished. And some of them, particularly these last couple of years when they had to do so much of their education online and they didn't get the hands-on stuff because of the pandemic, they really are struggling. And I think that's where mentorship is so important with those younger students. But mentorship them for ownership too. You know, talk about the money, show them what a P&L looks like, show them their own production. And these were all things that were very transparent for my practices. And having the entire team run the show takes a great deal of the burden off of the practice owner when you have collaboration and your entire team is helping you reach your goals. And you've got to take the time to do the meetings and do the training. And there's so many times I hear from practice owners, I don't have the time. And then I ask, do you have time to do surgery? Do you have time to make appointments? Well, yeah, well, this is just as important. You know, that is just as important. And we make time for what we value. So thank you for that. That one light is worth the whole hour. So thank you very much for shining a light on that, because I'm gonna share it out with everybody. Yes, let us teach our associates the value of being practice owners and have them not fear being a practice owner, because there is huge benefit to it. Absolutely huge benefit to it. Not to mention the fact the banks are completely comfortable with student loan debt. They do not even consider it as part of equation. So don't be afraid. The banks are behind
they
you.
Used to.
Yeah.
They used to. And I went to 8 banks to borrow $20,000 to buy my practice.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Well, now we have specific lenders who know that hospitals never default. Even if practice owners don't take any salary for themselves, by God, they pay those loans. And so the banks are like, yes, we love those boats. All right. Well, I say thank you very much. And we'll put your information for you guys who want to really follow some interesting conversations on LinkedIn. I suggest that you follow Dr. Tim Ireland and listen to his conversations and his thoughts on practice ownership and leadership in the veterinary profession, because he is speaking from words of wisdom out there and lots of trials by fire in life. And I feel like he's got the secret sauce, and we need to follow that secret sauce.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Nice talking to you, Tim. Thank you again.
All right. Take care.